Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere. Today's guest, here's a timely one, former United States Attorney Preet Bharara. When I went to meet with Bharara last week in his office at NYU Law School, just off Washington Square Park, I figured he'd be a good person to get a read on the Mueller special counsel investigation. He is, after all, a man who spent 8 years running one of the biggest and most active public corruption operations in the country when he was on the job as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is an office traditionally known for ambitious prosecutions run by big personalities. Bharara is very much in that line, and if you didn't know him from following what he'd been doing in New York, then you probably know him now from his initial strange bedfellows relationship with Trump to then getting thrown out along with the other Obama-appointed U.S. attorneys in March. Or maybe you know him from his new podcast. Yes, I had another podcast host on. It's called Stay Tuned with Preet, which is worth a listen to. Start out with the first episode in which he goes through his encounters with Trump from last November through March. He did that enough there that I decided not to repeat it in our conversation. But we did touch on some of the details he skipped over, including what his phone conversations with Trump were like during the transition and why he says they threw him off so much. I've known Preet myself since 2010, back when I was covering New York politics. He was new in the job as U.S. attorney, but I could already tell that he was going to be a real factor in politics since he had started taking down politicians and staffers at a surprisingly fast clip. So I wrote what I believe actually was the first big profile of him at the end of 2010. And as you'll hear me say to him, part of what made me think it was time to move on from the New York politics beat was how much of it became sitting at press conferences that he did, and he did a lot of them, with big flow charts and a whole production, somewhat theatrical, and then covering the special elections for the people he brought down. I want to oversell it. It's not the only reason why I decided it was time to move on, but it was one of those factors in there. You'll hear the effect of our many conversations over the years coming out and the ribbing back and forth and some of the jokes. But most of what we covered was the most serious of things. His feeling that the president was trying to maybe influence him. He compared Trump to the Godfather at one point. And what he makes of the criminal charges against close associates of the president. The things he won't talk about, like whether he was in the middle of investigating Trump when he got fired. Given the news, we rushed this one up. We pushed back one. It's a really great one we have coming with Nancy Pelosi. And since it was all happening really quickly, I emailed Preet about his reaction to the indictments and the plea deal. And this is what he wrote back. Hard to tell, but the George Papadopoulos guilty plea tells us A, Mueller is moving fast. B, the Mueller team keeps secrets well. C, more charges should be expected. And D, this team takes obstruction and lying very, very seriously. That should be of concern to some people. That Pelosi episode is coming in the next couple of days, and some of the others you'll hear in the next few weeks. Eric Holder, the former attorney general, and now the chair of the big Democratic redistricting group that's gotten off the ground. And Bill Perry, the former defense secretary, who now dreams of a nuclear apocalypse like every single day. Oh, and also Alec Baldwin and Bradley Whitford. That's Josh Lyman to all you West Wing fans out there. So subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever else you're listening to us on. Tell a friend and a coworker. Get everyone you know to subscribe. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. Like me on Facebook and email me with your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Preet Bharara. We ran into each other at the White House Correspondents' Dinner a couple years, or maybe a year after I moved from New York to Washington. And you said to me, why did I leave New York? And I said, which is true. Part of it was that I got tired of the beat in New York politics being waiting for you to lock somebody up, have a press conference about an indictment, and then wait for the special election to fill that seat. Which is a, like a, not
that's
a,
not really why you left.
No, that was a part of why I left. No.
Infinitesimal part.
Yeah.
But it was a nice story. But it's a nice
more
story.
To, no, it had more to do with the job offer from Politico. Right. But I don't want to give you too much credit.
But it's a fun and pandering way to begin your podcast.
That's what I try for as a podcast host.
I love, right? To be pandered to.
And you pander?
I don't pander on my podcast, which has been a minute and a half and you haven't mentioned yet.
Well, we'll do it in the intro, which we're going to record afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have any proof of that.
You're still being a U.S. attorney.
You may proceed, Isaac.
I may proceed, Counselor.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what from your the joke in Albany became that everybody thought that everyone else was wearing a wire.
I think the joke in Albany was Albany.
Yeah, well, that too.
Right.
There's nothing good about Albany, really. I don't think anybody would hold it up except for maybe the mayor of Albany.
You know, she and I had a a discussion about this once when I went to Albany to speak. And she said, naturally and understandably, one day in, you know, Albany's a great town and it has a lot of great people and it has a lot of great culture, et cetera. Don't malign Albany that way. And I understood her point, but it's the same way people talk about Washington. They say Washington is right. broken and Washington is terrible. So I tried to make a distinction between
it's
Albany,
not Albany, the
town. The
city, right? It's that few blocks around certain, the capital.
It's, you know, it's,
right?
It's the people who convene yes. for like whatever, a minute and a half a year who purport to legislate for us.
So from your thinking, what you saw, what percentage of government officials, of politicians are corrupt?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of corruption in the system that is institutionalized and that is considered lawful. You know, the old phrase is the scandal is right. what's legal.
Yes.
And there's a lot that's legal. But as a percentage matter, if you just look at the number of people who had been charged over a period of time, I think the statistic used to be, not just because of actions taken by my office, but other offices also, that you were more likely, if you were a state senator in New York, to be indicted and removed from office because of criminal charges than to be defeated at the polls. That's a stunning percentage, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, is this just, do you think it's like 10%, 20% of politicians, any group of politicians are going to be?
Look, I'll say it this way, in a way that often wasn't covered. I think the majority of politicians, whether they're state representatives and certainly federal representatives in the House and the Senate, are honorable and are feel good about public service and are doing things for the right reason. But if you have a substantial number of people who aren't. Yeah, I don't know what the percentage is because it's impossible to know. But anything more than zero should be unacceptable.
From what you've seen of the people who work for the president, do you think that percentage is higher?
I'm not describing a percentage. You know, to any White House or State House. The tone at the top, not just of a company, which is the famous phrase people use in business schools and, you know, management consulting firms, tone at the top is important. And if the tone at the top, whether you're a mayor or a governor or a president, is that you can flout the rules, and, you know, other people, you know, you don't have to follow, you know, ethical standards and traditions, and you don't have to provide your tax returns when you run for office, and you don't have to divest your interests, and you're allowed to tell your chief law enforcement officer who to investigate and who to lay off, that sets a standard and you become a role model for good or ill. And in environments like that, we have found, based on my experience, you tend to get more people who are not going into public service for the right reasons. You tend to get people like Secretary Price, who thought it was a good idea to take a chartered private airplane.
It's a Politico story, by the way, as long as we're talking about plugging.
That's why I was plugging it. Politico, good. Well done. But you get a person who thinks it's okay. It wasn't criminal, but you get a person who thinks it's okay to take a chartered private flight from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia. I mean, you've done that trip. I've done that trip a million times. You take the train. The train is faster, not to mention hundreds of thousands of dollars cheaper. And I think you have other examples of this, and this happens in state houses and it happens in city halls as well. If the tone from the top is it's okay, then other people are going to think that the rules don't apply to them either.
And so, not speaking in the abstract here, you feel like that tone is not there from the top in this presidency.
Yeah. I mean, hypothetically, if you're a president named Donald Trump and you had a secretary of Health and Human Services named Price, who thought that was okay. Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's not a partisan issue. I think we investigated and prosecuted more Democrats in New York than Republicans. And two of our biggest cases, one was a Democrat, one was a Republican. So I don't think it's about party at all. I don't think it's about ideology at all. I think it has to do with people who think that they're above the law and you're allowed to personally profit from your service and that you're special. And government officials aren't supposed to be special.
I was listening again to the first episode of your podcast.
Stay tuned with Preet.
Yeah. Yeah.
As you've gotten
available
very good
at applepodcasts.com.
Right.
Well,
and other places.
In the first episode, you tell the story of what happened with President Trump. And it's interesting to hear it in your own voice. You talk about how it's November 8th and you watch the election results and you know that there's going to be a change. When you were U.S. attorney, did you vote in elections?
I did not.
Because you felt like...
Part of the reason I didn't vote was, yeah, you know, look, I'm a private citizen now, and I live in a world in which I have views. And I had views, you know, before I became a United States attorney. I had views when I was the United States attorney. But your views when you're a U.S. attorney are, you keep them to yourself, and they don't inform in any way how you do your job. And for all intents and purposes, every prosecutor in the country, I think, should be, whether you're elected prosecutor as a Democrat or Republican, should be for all purposes an independent. And you shouldn't care about politics, and you shouldn't care about who recommended you, and you shouldn't care at whose pleasure you serve, whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president. And that's how I viewed the job, you know, completely apolitically. I didn't know the party affiliations of the people who worked for me. I didn't care about the party affiliations of the FBI agents and cops we worked with, nor did I care about the party affiliations of people we had to interact with in Washington at Justice Department headquarters. It's not what it's about. Now that I'm in the private sector and a private citizen, I have views about some things.
But you had views before.
But you keep them to yourself, and they don't inform your job at all. People should always, in a healthy way, hope that folks who are serving jobs that are supposed to be independently done, without fear of favor and without concern for politics, make sure they're living up to that. And one of the ways you live up to that is not to act in any way partisan, is not to talk in any way in a partisan way, to make it clear that the cases you're bringing are being brought on the merits. You're not favoring one side or the other. And I think the track record that we had in my office over 7.5 years, and it's, by the way, it's a long tradition going back. You know, my predecessors were appointed by Republican presidents, and I think were even-handed in how they handled things. And some were Democrats. Bob Morgenthau, you know, one of the great former prosecutors from my office, and then went on to become legendary district attorney in Manhattan. You know, he was an equal opportunity prosecutor, and I like to think that I was too. And there's a place for politics and engagement on political issues and issues of the day. And when you're a sitting prosecutor, line or otherwise, it's not the place for that.
The way that the president's supporters, a lot of them think about it, I think probably if you ask the president about you, at least at this point, would say, well, he's a Democrat. He worked for Chuck Schumer. He was appointed by Obama. Of course, he wasn't our guy.
I don't know what that means. You know, no United States attorney is supposed to be anybody's guy. The U.S. attorney in every district is supposed to serve the public and is supposed to be loyal to the Constitution. And I know there are some folks who have this view that other people are like they are, you know, deeply political people, whether you're talking about a governor of a state or, you know, a chief of staff to a president, think that everyone acts like they do. But there's a tradition in the Department of Justice and among, I think, the most dedicated law enforcement public officials that makes clear none of that matters. You know, a lot of cases just fall in your lap. And one of the first cases that I had to handle and make decisions about personally as a U.S. attorney happened 9 days into my tenure in 2009. And it was against a very, very prominent, well-known, wealthy Democratic fundraiser by the name of Hassan Namazi, who I think had given to Hillary Clinton and a number of Democrats. I think he might've been on the DNC, one of the committees. And he engaged in massive bank fraud to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And there was never any discussion at all, even though some people sort of marveled at it and said, well, it looks like Preet's being fair and not being political. It was not even a question. He was arrested, I think, 10 days after I started in the job because he had violated the law. And that's all that matters. And I worry that there are people like the president and others who cast so many aspersions on the motivations of career public officials in the Department of Justice or the Department of State or elsewhere with this largely nonsensical trope of the deep state, that there's a delegitimizing, not just of people in the Justice Department, but people in the press and people in the judiciary. And yeah, are there some people who have agendas who shouldn't? Sure. But the vast majority of people who I think who are on the bench and who work and toil away in relative obscurity, and often even in high profile positions in the Department of Justice, really don't care about politics. You know, I like to say often there should be three political parties in America: Republican, Democrat, and federal prosecutor. And the vast majority of what we did in my office it was not only was not affected by politics, but there was no political way to do it.
Well, he said, and you talk about the through the press in there, so I'll speak for the press here. He said in an interview recently, oh, there is a poll that said 46% of people believe that the press is making things up, and I'm proud of that. That's a good thing. And number one, that was actually a Politico poll. Second Politico plug there. How about that?
So you're undermining your own credibility. Stop doing those polls, man.
Well, you know, we need to see where people are thinking, but it's also this question of undermining the faith that people have in things. And it's not to say that there aren't journalists who haven't done things wrong and made errors. And I've had things that have had to be corrected. And usually it's minor things like this. This person gave $5 million, not $10 million or whatever. It's usually not even that big. But
we don't have to talk about the particular story, but, you know, I had an exchange with your publication last week that in an original version of the story, attributed to me a declaration that was 100% absolutely false. I complained about it and it took about 45 minutes and it was corrected. But, you know, for 45 minutes, I was unhappy and angry at your periodical because it was an easily checkable, documented fact that you got wrong.
And we corrected it and wrote that and that happens, right? I know that the reporter in question was regretful that it happened of having spoken with that person afterwards. But it's not, it's a different thing from saying that every reporter is out to do it, every federal prosecutor.
What Trump, I think, is trying to do, there are people seem to have these concerns that in some ways the Trump administration, the president himself, is successfully undermining certain institutions. And I don't think as a structural matter, he is able to do that, at least not yet. I think the courts are in pretty good shape. Structurally, they have, you know, independence, judges have in the federal system have life tenure. And so if the president mocks them or doesn't like them or intimidates them, nothing happens. They still go about doing their job. They may not like it and they may, you know, have a scotch that evening, and have to explain it to their neighbors, but nothing happens to them. If you're me, for example, you get a podcast at some point, because you don't have life
tenure.
You're
the only former U.S. attorney with a podcast.
Am I?
Of the ones who were given their walking papers.
I like to be a pioneer in all ways, Isaac. And I think also the press, you can intimidate, you can mock, you can complain, you can tweet about it. But, you know, you guys are pretty good because you got that amendment, the first one. And I don't think the libel laws, the slander laws are changing anytime soon. And the same with the Congress. The concern I have, though, is the power of the presidency is such and the bully pulpit of the presidency is such that what you can do effectively, at least with a segment of the population who supports you and who believes what you say, you can undermine their faith in all of these institutions, the courts, the press, the Congress, even an aspect of your own executive branch, you know, the law enforcement function. And over time, that's not good for anybody, because then the next time around when it's the other side, there may be a tendency, you know, an inclination or a temptation for the next person to try to undermine those very same institutions because there's a precedent for it, and to have, you know, institutions bend to the will of the other side. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's a Republican issue or Democratic issue, but the intentional, cynical, malicious undermining of the credibility of important institutions in America that are flawed, no doubt, is of great concern, but it is not of apocalyptic concern to me.
You have been pretty clear that you think that the meetings that the president has had with potential appointees, nominees to your old job are wrong, right? That was not a good thing to do.
They're not illegal and they're not without authorization, but there's a lot of things that a president is authorized to do. There are a lot of things you're authorized to do. A lot of things I was authorized to do legally as a United States attorney that can still be silly, stupid, counterproductive, and undermining of the law enforcement function. And I think this is an example. I mean, look, the president of the United States, if he wanted, could decide, you know, who should be the chiefs of public corruption. You know, he can go down to the granular level. And he said, you know what? I want to pick who should be the chief of public corruption in the Department of Justice. And I want to pick the chief of public. I want to pick. He could decide. You know, I personally want to pick who tries the case against an ally of his, which is not obstruction, which is not saying make the case go away. But he could say, I'm going to pick the worst person, the person with the worst trial record to try the case against my associate. I mean, that sounds silly. It sounds less silly today than it would have a year ago. He I think is within his legal right to do it. Would anybody say that that's wise? I don't think so. And in this, in a similar way, the idea that the president thinks it's a good idea to interview certain select candidates for the U.S. attorney position, given what happened with Jim Comey and Michael Flynn, given what happened with Jeff Sessions and Joe Arpaio, and given his interactions with me, and given the degree to which people have concern about this, that he's interviewing folks who are in offices that could investigate his property and his interests and his businesses, seems like a bad move.
But tell me why that's different from when you went to meet with him during the transition.
In all fairness, 100%, I went and met with him. I was already the U.S. attorney for 7.5 years.
But you were hoping to stay on the job, right?
I was told I was staying on the job. And yeah, in an ideal world, he wouldn't have asked for that meeting. He shouldn't have asked for that meeting. By the way, I am not faulting in any way the people who have agreed when asked for the meeting to go do the meeting. I'm not casting aspersions on their integrity or on their ethics or on their independence when, again, because it's lawful. When someone decides, to say, I want to talk to you, I think it's not crazy to go talk to that person. What I do think is important, because there's some history since the November 30th meeting that I had with him, you know, most notably, he's not the president-elect anymore. He's the president. Is evidence that in meetings, not with me, it didn't happen with me, but in other meetings, including with Jim Comey, there's very credible evidence that the president, when alone with Jim Comey, asked him for his personal loyalty.
He never asked you for his personal, loyalty.
No, he didn't say anything like that to me. But there has now been a bunch of things that have happened, including the firing of Jim Comey under weird circumstances and the discussion of the Russian investigation, an ask of personal loyalty, a direction to think about dropping a case against a personal ally and friend and former White House official. And in light of all, so for example, if I had been asked today, if I was still in the job and there had been no indication about whether I should stay or go, and the president of the United States asked me to come meet with him, I would say no. I wouldn't go to that
meeting.
But you
said no already when to call him back, right?
Well, because things began to happen. And so when he called as president, which was not a pro forma meeting, after telling me that through Chuck Schumer that he wanted me to stay, it was a courtesy meeting. Lots of things have unfolded. And so, I didn't return the call for precisely this reason, precisely this concern. And so the other thing I think is important.
So if let's say things had proceeded and the Comey meeting, the Comey situation hadn't happened and we didn't know about the meeting with the loyalty pledge request. The other U.S. attorneys had been asked as a standard situation to resign, as happens when there's a change in administrations and parties. If the president had asked for somebody to come do an interview with him, that would be less of an alarm for you. It's only because of what you see. Because that seems to be the difference from your situation.
Everything is a balance, and it's a combination of circumstances, right? My antenna went up when I was asked to go meet with him on November 30th, but not sufficiently that I thought, okay, don't do it. And as more evidence comes to light and as more things happen, then you adapt to those situations and you understand what the appearance is. And by the way, it's a bad move for a lot of reasons, but mostly it's a bad move for the president, because now he's undermining the credibility potentially of the people who will be scrutinized for what they do and what they don't do. And, when I didn't return the phone call on President Trump on March 9th, 22 hours before I was asked to resign, the person probably most protected by that was the president himself. Because he's the person who presumably, depending on what evidence would have shown, would have had something to gain. Not the person who's, multiple levels removed in the hierarchy of government, but the president himself, who either is trying to do a favor for an ally, hypothetically, or trying to do something that's damaging to an adversary.
I wonder if those chit-chat conversations that you had two phone calls after the meeting that you just said were innocent, nothing happened.
I didn't say they were innocent. I said nothing untoward happened in those calls.
What happened in those? What were those calls?
They were chatty calls of the sort that I heard some months later Jim Comey describe that he had with the president as well. How's it going? What's going on? I'm working on my speech. Everyone treating you well. He would talk about how much press he was getting about various things. They were short. They were
2 minutes, 5 minutes,
like, I don't know, 5 minutes. One of them, which I got, 2 days before he was inaugurated as the president of the United States, when you would think he would have other things going on. He talked about how he was working on his speech. He was talking about how governors were coming to see him because they wanted a lot of money. And, you know, he kind of said he appreciated the attention. And again, each of those things on their own, I don't think necessarily means anything, but you see a pattern of conduct happen. What is the reason for the busiest man on the planet who has business interests and property in a certain place, spending time in the middle of his day, calling someone without the attorney general, without telling the attorney general's office, as far as I know, without necessarily having any other staff around or on the phone, with no warning, developing a personal telephonic chummy relationship with an independent United States attorney in New York? And you know what? In an abundance of caution, I think you would have been wise not to have that kind of communication.
Answer your own question. What do you think the reason is?
This is speculation, but based on my common sense understanding of how the world works, my better understanding now of how Donald Trump works, my understanding of the interactions he's had with Jim Comey and Jeff Sessions and other people, this is a person who is a transactional player in the world. That's how he did what he did in his business. And that's how he thinks, I think, the justice system is supposed to work. And why not have people on your side? Because at some point, you know, like the Godfather says, you know, the Godfather may come to you for a favor. You don't know what that is. You don't know if it'll ever come. But my suspicion is that one day it might have come. That's all. And I'm not making an
answer. So Trump is very the Godfather clear.
He's not a very good Godfather, actually. He's not jolly enough. Look, it otherwise makes no sense. I was not important enough, except in one regard, right? I was not close enough, except in one regard. And
did he have reason to think that you were looking at things?
I don't know what he had reason to think about anything. What I do know is, I don't talk about the things that we were examining and investigating during the time I was U.S. attorney, and including on the day that I left that job. But there would be people who would know what we were looking at, including the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, because we provided summaries of significant and sensitive cases that we have been working on, and that's all I'll say.
Do you think Comey should have met with him?
Look, so the FBI director is different, and it's more complicated. There's really no reason for the United States attorney to have a relationship with the president, because as I said, most of what we do is not about policy. It's about enforcing laws against particular people. And it is a huge no-no for any political official, and certainly the president, to have any input on who we're investigating or who we shouldn't investigate. And given that's almost all of what we do in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the building of a relationship between the president and the U.S. attorney makes no sense at all. The FBI director, on the other hand, has a principal role in defending the country against harm, against cyber threats, against terrorist threats. It's an intelligence gathering institution.
Yeah, but Comey never met with Obama. I think it was two times he met with Obama, right? It was not like long dinners, like the main event that he's described having with President Trump.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's wholly normal. I'm just saying it's less abnormal because the FBI director has a role in briefing political figures and people who were responsible for the military and responsible for protecting America also, to provide assessments of what the threat matrix is, to provide assessments of how international operations are going in capturing terrorists and that sort of thing, just like the CIA director. He's not the CIA director, but it's a similar kind of role. So it's not as nutty for someone to want to talk to the FBI director. But again, you know, you learn by experience. And what we know from Jim Comey, whatever you think of him, he began to be uncomfortable with those kinds of meetings also. So I think it's a difficult thing and an odd thing for most people to understand to say no to a phone call or a meeting with the president of the United States at whose pleasure you serve. And I get that. And, you know, it was not an easy or small thing for me not to return a phone call from the president. And I did owe him my continued, position in the job, but I didn't owe him my loyalty. And I just have seen what has happened in the world before. I saw what happened, as I've said many times, when there happened to have been this meeting on the tarmac between Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch. And that supposedly was also an innocuous conversation, chit-chat, of the sort that I told you that Donald Trump had with me. And yet that chit-chatty conversation, Donald Trump himself used to great effect and malicious attack on both parties, on Loretta Lynch and on Bill Clinton, and suggested, I don't believe that. Why on earth would they be meeting on the tarmac?
You know Loretta Lynch yourself from serving alongside her as U.S. attorney.
Yeah, I don't believe anything untoward happened. But the point is, Donald Trump himself made it a big deal at rally after rally after rally, saying that was a corrupt meeting, even though he had no evidence anything untoward was said, merely because of the fact of the meeting and because there was a pending investigation with respect to Bill Clinton's wife. Now, for me, he may or may not have known about things that I have been requested to investigate, and yet he was choosing to have a private phone call with me with no one around. And I remember thinking, well, how is that different from the tarmac meeting, except at the lower level? How is that different from the tarmac meeting that he so vociferously attacked maliciously and maybe not even completely incorrectly in the minds of many people, but he did that time and time again. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to put myself or him in the same position.
So you're not going to talk about what you were working on in the office, as you said, but I'm going to ask you this way. Are there things beyond what is public that you have seen about President Trump and people who are associated with him that inform your thinking about him?
That inform my thinking about
President, about Donald Trump, about people who work for him or associates of him?
That's a clever question.
I'm a clever journalist.
Politico, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good podcast. Yeah. No, I don't think so. Look, my view of
no, there are
my view. I'll say this: my view of the president is informed by what I have observed personally, my interactions with him, and what I've read, and the credibility I put in the accounts of other people who I think have greater credibility than he does. Which is, by the way, a position shared by not by more than zero Republican senators of his own party.
There are a lot of people who have noted the paperwork problems that people who work for the president seem to have. They forget to file forms or they leave information off of forms. They have often cast this as innocent mistakes. Are they innocent mistakes?
I don't know. It depends on the particular case.
From your experience, when people...
Sometimes people make mistakes, yeah. Look, it all depends on the frequency, on the... on common sense and how complicated people's holdings are. So yeah, are there times that people make errors? Sure. If you can ask me about a particular person, I still won't answer because I don't know. I don't know all the facts. I'm not in a position, as much as people want me to be in that position, to opine on whether someone did something and it's innocent or not innocent. I feel more comfortable opining on whether it's, something is smart to have done. Like, I think it's not smart for the president to be interviewing people in the districts where they could be investigating him. But I don't know if something's innocent or not.
You know Bob Mueller. You are an educated reader of tea leaves.
Am I?
Yes, you were.
I don't think I took that class.
Well, I think sitting in the U.S. Attorney's office for 8 years will do that.
I don't even drink tea.
And yet you're Indian. No tea for you.
Wow. Let's leave that interesting ethnic comment in the final. Can we do that? I'm looking at the producer. Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. Great.
It's just a good hearted
joke. I'm sending this to my parents.
Do you think that do you anticipate that there will be charges from what you've seen?
I don't know. I don't know my concern is that if there are, you're going to have tens of millions of people who will say, praise the Lord, this is terrific. And that's just, and tens of millions of people who will think that Bob Mueller is a devil and is political, even though I know he's not. And the reverse will also be true. If he decides there's no charge to bring against anyone or there's no referral to be made properly to the House of Representatives in terms of impeachment, that you'll have those populations reversed. And people will say he's terrible and he's the devil. And other people will say, oh, look, we like Bob Mueller after all. And it has nothing to do with the facts or the law. It's going to have to do with what people's political preference is. And that concerns me a lot, that we become so polarized. And maybe it's not possible not to be this way when the potential target of an investigation is a presidential candidate or a president himself, because people's opinions about those folks can't be separated. Opinions about those folks and their conduct, the legality of their conduct can't be separated from their view of them as people or as leaders. But it is a very dangerous thing. I don't know how we get out of it, that you have half the country often, and I see this on my Twitter feed a lot, wanting the president to be indicted, because they want him gone.
Because they don't agree with him politically.
Because they don't agree with him politically. And I think a lot of people have it morph in their head. They conflate guilty of a crime with we don't like them politically. And by the way, this is precisely the kind of thing that many people on the other side did with Hillary Clinton, literally chanting at rallies, lock her up, lock her up. Now, look, there is a plausible argument that one could make legally with respect to Hillary Clinton, I suppose. And there's also a plausible argument that could be made now with respect to Donald Trump, that he should be charged from the evidence we have. But no decision has been made. And maybe people are wrong about that.
Do you think that from what you can see, is there enough?
I don't know. You know,
obviously from what is public, what Mueller's got, we don't know.
I think there are things that are public that are very damning. But, you know, I investigated cases for a lot of years and oversaw investigations. And there are many cases that look damning in the second month of investigation. And that's why you're investigating them. And you have all the terrible evidence. And by the way, a lot of the terrible evidence, you know, the damning evidence is the stuff that ends up you know about. And the exculpatory things, if they exist, were the things that show what else is on someone's mind that were more innocent and less nefarious, tend to be known to only the prosecutor, which is why people sometimes get upset when no case is brought. So I don't know what mitigating factors there are. I don't know. You know, I had just to plug my podcast again. You know, Ben Wittes and I, you know, who runs the Lawfare blog, you know, was very, I thought, you know, smart about these issues.
But he said that he thought the president should be impeached, and he said he didn't think it was a radical thing to say. Well, do you agree with that?
Distinguish two things. You're asking.
No, that was an indictment versus impeachment thing, right?
Impeachment is a political act. He said he would have no problem if he were in Congress voting to impeach the president, because the things we know so far show that he has abused his power, et cetera. I think absolutely the president has abused his power, if you're not using that as a term of art legally. But he said there are lots of issues potentially with respect to whether or not you have met the elements of a crime, including all the mixed reasons that Donald Trump himself has given for why he fired Jim Comey. If you're taking that as one of the singular events, one of the things he said on Lester Holt was that I had Russia on my mind, but he also says that he was upset with Jim Comey because, in this, I believe not so much, but he said because the FBI is in disarray and he's not doing a great job as FBI chief. And that would be a legitimate reason. And he also said that he was upset at Jim Comey for not publicly saying that Donald Trump was not under investigation. That's also not criminal if a jury were to believe that that was the principal reason or the only reason for firing. So there's a lot of considerations. I don't know all the facts.
So you're not sure about the indictment threshold, but you feel like maybe he's met the impeachment threshold?
I actually have never said anything about whether or not he's met either of those thresholds. Ben Wittes felt comfortable saying if you were a member of Congress. I don't. But I am comfortable being critical of conduct that has taken place and of ways that he's undermined.
Why don't you feel comfortable saying you're a private citizen?
Because you know what? I still think that if I were a member of Congress, I would want to full and fairly evaluate everything. And there's a process there too. And at this point, sitting where I sit, I'm not prepared to say how I would vote on that question.
You brought up the correction that we had to make in the Politico story, but I actually want to ask you about it, which was...
Look, it's not good for you. No, it was a big error.
Well, it was an error in which it said that it was this question of whether you were investigating Donald Trump when you were fired. And
the article said... I wasn't going to bring it up.
No, I'm bringing it up.
First with the T comment, and now with this. Your article said, out of nowhere, that I had declared or proclaimed that I was investigating Donald Trump
and his
associates at the time I was fired. And I never said that. And I would never say that. I'm not answering that question. And you shouldn't infer, by the way, dear listener, that means I was or was not. Once you start getting in the habit of saying, I learned this a long time ago. Once you start getting in the habit of saying that on one occasion, you deny having done an investigation, then people assume the other time you don't deny it, that you must have been doing it. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. Have a sip of your tea.
I don't have any tea. You didn't offer me any.
Yeah. Well, see, that should tell you something.
Do you stay in touch with the people that you worked with at the U.S. Attorney's office?
Yeah. Some of my best friends in the world are people who used to be there, and some of them are still there. Absolutely.
And do you ever talk about cases with them?
Never. I mean, the one thing that people don't get, whether it's my old office or it's the Mueller team, the special counsel's office. People love to say prosecutors leak. You know, it is really, really rare among the groups that I have associated myself with. And, you know, other people have information about things. It would never cross my mind to ask what's going on with the, even some of the cases that I used to investigate and I know a lot about, and it would never occur to them to tell me.
What do they make of your new life?
I don't know. I think they listen to the podcast, some of them. I think. I hope so.
Do they know that you're sitting in this office at NYU and you haven't even put your things on the walls? And...
Yeah. yeah. I they may know that. I don't have a lot of visitors. You guys are among the first.
Your joke in the ad for the podcast was that you miss having subpoena power.
That wasn't a joke, man. You can get a lot done with a subpoena.
I'm curious. You are, there are not a lot of people who make the transition into, doing interviews later in life. You spoke with people, interviewed them in the legal context. How is it different doing it for podcasts?
I have to be nicer in the podcast. I had on my podcast, there's another episode that people should listen to, a guy by the name of John Miller. John Miller is an interesting figure.
John Miller, it happens, is one of the pseudonyms that apparently Donald Trump used to use.
Not that John Miller, different John Miller. John Miller is currently the head of counterintelligence at the New York Police Department, but he has a very impressive career as a journalist. He used to be at CBS. He used to be, I believe, at ABC. He was one of the few human beings in the world who, as a journalist, got an interview with Osama bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan before he became a household name and known as the face of evil. And he tells that story on the podcast. You can listen to it. I think it's episode 3 or 4. And I asked him this question, you know, how weird is it for you to have been a journalist and, you know, pursuing stories and interviewing people like John Gotti and other bad people and good people, and now being responsible for protecting the city? And investigating and overseeing investigations of homicides sometimes. And he said, it's a lot of it. It's the same job. It's an inquiry for truth. It's to how to get information. It's to cut through nonsense. And so some of that is the same. But it's a little bit different too.
Has it changed your perspective on the media?
I think my perspective on the media has always been, a healthy one. The media sometimes, makes me angry because it does get a lot of things wrong. And I say to someone who really respects the free press, which is, as many people say, a better way of describing the media than the media. The media doesn't sound particularly impressive or
media sounds evil and it's,
well, it's, you know, fake media.
Yeah.
But the free press, and I have always, and you know this, I have always credited the free press on a number of accounts. One is, that they can often bring to light bad things that are happening in the world, corruption and otherwise, that government officials can't get to. Because people sometimes, you know, we made the joke about subpoena power a second ago, but, you know, there are some people who won't talk to an FBI agent and they won't respond to a subpoena and they hunker down and they get counsel. And there are some people who will talk to someone like you. I find that shocking. But there are times where people will talk to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're probably not as bright as some other people, but they will.
Most of them wouldn't have to not be in order to
probably offer, if they're Indian American, you probably offer them tea.
That's going to keep going on.
I'm going to keep going there. It's going to make it harder for you to edit this out. If I have my outrage about your tea comment peppered throughout the interview, I don't know how you're going to surgically remove it.
I don't know why you think that we would remove it.
Well, because I don't know what's going to happen.
Podcast host honor here.
Yeah, okay.
I made a silly joke, and you've decided to hold me to it.
I don't know. Like, you know, maybe people will make a judgment about whether that was a good joke or not.
I just said it was a silly joke.
So the press does a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of press, and I've had a lot of fights with folks about what is true or not. The president of the United States, and that's natural. The president of the United States takes it to a whole new cynical level, and as he likes to say, the likes of which the world has never seen.
That's a very favorite comment of
his. In a leader like that. Yeah. And so I think that's troubling. And, you know, there are some instances in which people in the press, in the free press, make innocent mistakes, like I think was made last week with you, even though it shouldn't have been made. And look, there is bias in the press, and there are some, you know, press outlets that are proudly biased in one direction or the other. And nobody likes to get bad press. you know, press people don't like to get bad press.
You were, when you were U.S. attorney, known for doing these big press conferences. And
I don't know what big means. I made a big deal
out of press conferences.
I don't know what that means. Look, I don't mean to be quibbling with you. When a case happened, like every other United States attorney, like every other prosecutor in America, they got up at a podium and they announced the charges. Now, I happen to think that during the time I was there, we had a lot of important high-profile cases to bring that any U.S. attorney in the country would have stood at a podium and announced those charges.
You had graphics sometimes flowcharts.
I don't know why that makes it big. It doesn't make it big. It makes it explainable. But what I thought was very important, and part of the reason I'm doing the podcast now as a private citizen, is I really feel strongly that people should understand what their government is doing. And I know like some people, particularly defense lawyers, like to say, because I would expect them to say this, that someone is trying to, you know, try a case in the press. A prosecutor's job alone is not going to solve any deeply seated social problem, economic problem, public safety problem at all. And I have a view that's a little bit more expansive than some, less expansive than others, is that I don't only want to hold folks accountable who get held accountable in courts of law, but also deter other people from engaging in that conduct. And so if we remove a corrupt politician, but another corrupt politician takes that person's place the next day, no one's life has been improved, even though you have done justice by holding one person accountable. The same is true in gangs. So I viewed my role as being, you know, prosecutors are not required to be mute, and they shouldn't be mute. DAs and U.S. attorneys both. Also true of presidents, also true of attorneys general. There were things that we could inform the public about that I thought was useful for me to provide a perspective on, and that's why I did that.
This was not what you wanted to be doing, sitting, though you have a nice office at NYU and a podcast and all the rest. What
are you talking about this moment with you?
All of it together.
I'm having a great time.
But I'm wondering, given what's happened, what do you think? What's your dream job at this point? There was thought.
I had my dream job. My dream job was being in an office with, we talked a lot about me, but the reason that office did well and the reason you're even talking to me is because on any given day, there were 450 people, half of them lawyers, half of them not, who were doing God's work. And whether you agreed with all their decisions or not, we're trying to make the country better. We're trying to make the city and the state more fair. We're trying to bring integrity into government, we're trying to keep the markets honest. And the finest group of public servants I've ever met.
But there was a lot of speculation that you might want to be attorney general.
People love to speculate.
Right? Not that it was based on anything necessarily. That you'd want to be on the Supreme Court. I heard that rumor around.
I don't want to be a judge of any sort. So you hear these things. And this is why sometimes people talk about fake news.
Well, people speculate.
Right. So it's speculation.
Right. Do you think
you want to talk more about speculation?
No,
my favorite movie line about that is it's from Miller's Crossing. Geez, Tom, you know I don't know nothing. I was just speculating about a hypothesis. There's a lot of that in the press.
Yeah, that's part of the job description sometimes.
Yeah, we should do less of that.
Politics, government. Is any of that in your future?
Those are two different things.
So, is politics in your future?
No.
Is government in your future?
If there's something that some place I can serve. I think I can make a difference in the future. Yeah, I would consider that.
So all the people who think about like you running for office one day, they're just wrong.
Correct.
What in government do you think you would want to do?
I dumbfounded you? Have I stopped you cold?
No.
You've been really good so far. Now you're yammering.
I'm wondering in government if you...
You can still ask those follow-ups.
No, I have no... That's it. That's my last question, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And what was it?
In government, what would you want to do?
You know, I don't know. Look, right now, I'm doing everything I can to delay indefinitely or forever when I might have to go to a private law firm, which has been the course, and probably represent people accused of crimes, which is can be a noble thing to do
as well.
No offense to NYU, it pays better than NYU, but you know, I have other things on my mind, and you know, unlike every other person who has had my job, I think in modern history, who has gone directly to a high-paying law firm, I'm trying to see if I can make doing something different for a while and talking about things I care about, even without subpoena power, writing a bit, talking to folks, talking to you. I'm writing a book that I care about. I'm going to teach a class on justice and fairness issues in the spring at NYU Law School. I'm commentating from time to time on CNN. And if I can make a living doing that for a while and maybe even longer, I find that more fulfilling.
So last question is, do you want President Trump to come on your podcast?
He's welcome anytime. I might not be quite as jovial during the second part of that interview, but I would start that way.
The first part, you'd be jovial?
Of course. That's how it works.
So there's some food for thought. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe for all those episodes coming up, from Alec Baldwin and Bradley Whitford to Eric Holder and Nancy Pelosi. Follow me on Twitter and like me on Facebook at Isaac Dover. Email me your thoughts and suggestions, Isaac@politico.com. Catch you next time on Off Message.